Welcome to The Sound of Economics. My name is Guntram Wolf and I'm the director of Bruegel. And today I'm joined by Alan Beattie, who is a senior writer for the Financial Times, working on trade issues and writing for Trade Secrets, the FT's newsletter on trade. Welcome, Alan.
Thank you for having me.
And I'm also joined by André Sapir, senior fellow here at Bruegel. Welcome, André.
Thank you.
So today we want to discuss trade, obviously, trade and the global economy. And Alan will join us quite regularly to discuss with us these trade issues. But today we thought we start with the discussion on trade tariffs, on car tariffs that the US president is contemplating to impose on European, but also on other cars, on the basis of security grounds. And then we want to open up, because he hasn't taken a decision yet, and talk a bit more about whether or not the security clause is actually a sensible clause in the WTO and the way and in the US debate, and whether the US president is actually abusing this clause as of now. Well, let's start with you, Alan, just to walk us through. This has been an incredibly busy week. Everybody was expecting the president to make a decision and take a decision yesterday. He was probably busy with the impeachment discussion. But where do you see the US debate on this current?
Yes, nothing is ever certain where Trump is concerned, even when he's going to make the announcement. The interesting thing about this is that almost no one in the US thinks this is a good idea. almost no one in the administration does. Even people like Wilbur Ross, the Commerce Secretary, who's normally quite gung-ho for trade wars. And the car industry itself, because it relies on imported parts and so forth, even that doesn't want protection against European imports. I think pretty much the only person who does is Peter Navarro, who's the president's economic advisor, who is basically gung-ho for putting tariffs on anything in all directions at all times. So really the interesting thing is whether or not Trump, as he has done before, to be fair, but not to this extent, is prepared to defy economic logic and political pressure and the advice of almost everyone around him and put those tariffs on.
But if I may, I mean, the threat of tariffs has already been extremely successful, hasn't it? I mean, Volkswagen has announced that it wants to build a factory for electric cars in the US. The same has done BMW. Mercedes is also contemplating increasing its production capacities in the US. So isn't Trump achieving what he wants by just leaving the threat out there? And, you know, European companies fall in line and shift their production to the US.
To be honest, I think there's an element of people rebadging stuff that they would have done anyway. I think it's kind of hard to imagine that in a globally integrated car market, you're going to really affect supply chains in any meaningful sense. I think there's more likely that you will do damage to the US car industry simply by putting this political risk and uncertainty over it.
Well, I see, André, you're perhaps not fully agreeing. What's your take on this?
No, I do think that the threat story very much fits with his pattern. I think when we look at the car, the steel, and now the Chinese issue, I think he understands very much that we are a year away from the election, that he has to be very mindful of not disturbing the good economic indicators that he has, both for the stock exchange and for unemployment. And that, as you know, all the studies and everything that comes out of the IMF and other places shows that the trade war is weighing on the global economy and potentially on the US economy. And so I think he's backtracking from measures, but he's not backtracking from threats. And I do think that the threats that he continues to wield do have an impact, because the US economy and the US market is large enough that indeed those threats, I think, and, you know, contrary to what Alan says, I do think that they are modifying the global value chains, and that indeed European firms that indeed were already present in the US, but you can shift a little bit your production, and I think they are doing that. I don't think it's a good idea, and I don't think it's a good idea to be in a world where, you know, the more you scream, the more you change global value chains, but I think It is going on, yes.
Alan, any reply to that point? Or,
I mean, you know, it's very hard to construct a counterfactual of what would happen anyway. I think in the long term, however, it's hard to see that you know, an industry as complex and liquid as the as the car industry is going to be materially affected by a, you know, a threat from a president who, after all, may only be in office another year. And I think there's a large extent to which a lot of countries and even companies are kind of waiting to see what will happen in a year's time, whether or not certainly the US will continue to have, let's say, a robust mercantilist policy, but whether it will be quite as destructive as this one.
Just to pick up on the point of André, that the measures themselves, he's backtracking perhaps a bit from implementing new measures because they weigh on the economy. Is that your sense, Alan, that there is sort of an element of rationality here in the US debate? And let's push that a bit. I mean, sure, the tariffs against China and the counter tariffs have been harmful to even farmers in the United States. But he sort of turned around the narrative quite nicely and sort of makes this really a blame game where China is to be blamed. Is he sort of seeing that this is more difficult to do with the European trading partners than with the Chinese ones? Or is there no rationality here? Or is it, I mean, where do you see him? Is he really backtracking, or is he just sort of pausing?
I think it's always difficult to look for rationality in Donald Trump, because every time he makes a decision, there are so many possible factors that the decision, as it were, overdetermined. You can always point at one and say, oh, he's making the decision for that reason. And then when the next decision comes, it turns out he's not, you know, he's not responding to that. It was always said that he was obsessed with the S&P and that his decisions went up and down with the S&P. But then that proved not to be true, because he was quite happy to take decisions that knocked the stock market down. It's always said he's obsessed with the elections, but then he took decisions not far before the midterms, which were damaging to the economy, you know. And the narrative I hear now is he's a deal maker. What he wants to do is present the American people with a whole bunch of deals before the next election. Now, that is consistent with the current set of policies. Certainly, he's agreeing a very weak deal with China to buy some kind of peace. He's got a rather weak deal, or rather weak conversation with the EU about liberalization and tariffs, which is not really going to produce anything before the election, but which he can portray as a deal. However, I think it would be very foolish for anyone to rely on this as a predictor of what he's actually going to do over the next 12 months, because he's just shown over the last 3 years that he doesn't have a stable reaction function. You can't actually predict what he's going to do based on any kind of normal, you know, set of motives and factors.
Okay, so a very unpredictable U.S. president, but let's talk a bit about the more technical question, which is why he's using national security and how does it work? I mean, is a car a national security threat? It's difficult to understand that. The same with steel. I mean, he used national security as an argument to put a tariff on steel. That's very, very difficult to understand. But can you just explain why that clause was used? And on Pips, André, you want to start kicking us off on that? Why is that the right? I mean, why legally is that the way he has chosen to go about?
Okay, I think we should start by making a distinction between the national security clause in U.S. law and national security in the WTO. So there is a clause in both, and he has used the national security clause in U.S. law for steel and for the car. And that means that, in fact, the president requested from the Department of Commerce to launch an investigation as to whether or not there may be a national security problem. Was the steel industry dwindling to such an extent that it was posing a national security threat to the United States? Likewise, for the car industry. And in both cases, there has been a determination by the Department of Commerce, following a whole process, a legal process in the US with hearings and all the, you know, economic studies that has shown that yes, the imports in the US, both in steel and in cars, have resulted in a shrinking of the domestic industry to an extent that it may pose, or it does pose, a national security threat. And then the president has to decide, based on that finding from the Department of Commerce, whether or not to put trade measures.
So when was that? Sorry, that assessment from the Department of Commerce.
So that
just a year ago, too.
No, for the car that was in the summer, beginning of the summer.
But for the steel.
For the steel that was now.
A few years ago.
Yes, a year and a half ago.
But the argument being that if you don't have domestic steel production, you can't build your tanks anymore. Or
exactly, exactly, okay, exactly. Right, okay. And they determine actually what is the capacity that the US industry should have in order to be viable from a national security viewpoint, and that it had fallen below that. And therefore that they need to increase capacity, and the way to increase capacity is to reduce imports. And that's the way the president has put the measures. Now, those measures are potentially compatible with the WTO rules, because there is a clause in the WTO, Article 21, that does allow a country to impose trade restrictions based on national security. Now, very few countries have ever used that possibility, have ever notified to the WTO trade measures based on the national security. And the view was always that the clause in the WTO is a bit vague and leaves the door open to much abuse. And therefore, that countries should be worried to launch the use of this, because then other countries would do that. And indeed, when the US did, and it had been used very, very rarely in the past. So when President Trump decided to use that clause and to put the steel tariff, obviously everybody was very, very worried that, you know, the US is doing that. There may be other cases as now coming with cars, and then other countries may also start to abuse, in a sense, the system and say, well, you know, we need to put measures based on national security. And, you know, what exactly is national security? And would the WTO judges, if it came to that, would they have the courage to take on the case? Or would they say, well, you know, national security, yes, it's there, but, you know, who are we, the judges of the WTO, to decide that something is or not in a national security? So it was viewed as opening really a can of worm that once opened, you would not be able to close, and, you know, it would spill over. So that's what happened with steel, and that has been the worry with the cars, apart from the measures themselves. And then we can discuss, and we are going to do this in a moment, what have been the consequences.
What can be done about it.
And what can be done, and what has happened in Geneva, and how countries have reacted to the measures which the US has taken in the case of steel, so far only, not for cars yet, based on the national security, both the US clause and the WTO clause.
Alan, what can be done and should be done about it, both in Geneva but also, of course, here in Brussels?
Well, first of all, can I just say, one of the main reasons in reality that Trump chose the national security route is that he can do it on his own. It's unilateral executive. You know, if it comes to actually writing a trade deal, the US Congress has a huge amount of power, as he's discovered rewriting NAFTA. However, using national security is something that can be done just by the president. And although Congress has occasionally talked a good game about reining him in and not letting him use these powers, as usual, the Republicans in Congress have no spine, and they haven't done anything. Now,
is it both houses in Congress or...
I don't think there's no, it would actually be mainly the Senate that would do this, and the Senate, or certainly the holdup is in the Senate because of the, you know, the strength of the Republicans there. And they've talked about it, but haven't done it. Now,
if I may, he can use other trade remedies, other trade measures, safeguards, and he can also do this.
Without Congress.
Without Congress. He can also use it. But in the case of safeguards, then which are the more legal sort of way to do said, well, you know, I have a problem, not a national security. There is a threat to my industry. Well, there is a way to do that in the WTO, which is not opening this, you know, huge alley of, you know, unknown territory that the national security does. There are other instruments, and earlier presidents had used it, and he could have done that.
And why did he?
Clearly, because I think clearly he wanted to challenge. I mean, it's the case that he's not taking just measures. He's clearly, I think, trying to undermine the system. And that, I think, is the main issue, is that we are not dealing with a president who believes in the system. Because if you look at President Bush...
So the system being the World Trade Organization...
The World Trade System, that's right. Because back in 2002, on steel issues, President Bush Jr. also put tariffs of 25%. But those were notified as safeguard. And then the president could do it on his own as well. But in a sense, it was more in the framework of the spirit of the system. He was not violating the system. I think here, really, apart from wanting to put measures and having the executive authority to do that, he was sending a very strong signal to the WTO that he's willing to really shake the system.
Well, I mean, there's a slight difference in safeguards, in which there's supposed to be a sort of evidentiary bar, particularly with regard to the WTO itself. Now, what happened with Bush and the steel tariffs is, I mean, it was incredibly cynical. It was purely and simply in order to win the midterm elections in, I think, 2002. He put them on. The EU took him to the WTO. He won the elections, or the Republicans won the elections, and he took them off again. Now, the interesting thing is the EU is behaving now kind of as it did then. One, it started a case against the US, against the steel and aluminium tariffs. And two, it's actually treated these as though they were safeguards, and sort of automatically, they call it rebalancing, but in effect, it's a form of sort of unilateral retaliation straight away against the US. Now, to my mind, both of these are quite dangerous. Bringing a case against the US to the WTO is dangerous because, as we were saying before, using national security as a reason to impose trade barriers is something that's not been done very often, and it's not been done because it's very dangerous. If you ask a dispute settlement body, a panel, to say, no, we don't think that these measures are necessary for national security, you can imagine how that will go down in Washington. Whether or not Trump is in the White House, three people you've never heard of sitting in Geneva telling the United States of America that they can second guess its national security needs is extremely explosive. And the automatic rebalancing, as it were, the U.S. is not at all clear that that's legal under the WTO, and so the U.S. has brought a counter case against the EU for that. There is one thing I will say, there's one bright spot here, which is the timing. The case that the EU and others brought against the U.S. for the steel and aluminium safeguards as of September has now been punted off, and so there is not going to be a ruling until, what they say, at least autumn 2020. So it may well be, let's all hope, that that's not actually going to come until after the US presidential election. So if there is going to be a massive political explosion, at least it will be after Election Day.
I mean, just to unpack that a little bit more. So the EU went to Geneva to challenge imposition of tariffs on steel based on national security grounds, in turn, you think that might be quite explosive, because judges in Geneva should judge on national security. But the EU also actually imposed retaliatory tariffs. That's the famous Harley-Davidson that was sort of imposed a tariff on, which in a sense might also not be WTO compatible as a measure if the judges in Geneva were to find that that this is actually a justified tariff or based on steel on security grounds. So why did the EU immediately react with retaliatory tariffs in this case?
I think they felt they had to, for political reasons, that they just couldn't sit there and see their own industries being hit. And I think, I'm not sure I would have done this if I were the EU, or assuming I could have found the political space not to do it, as it were. I think the EU is kind of working off an old playbook. they're treating the US administration as they might have done previous administrations in some sort of rational game, as indeed they did the George W. Bush administration. You know, you hit back, you take it to the WTO, you hope there's a conversation there, and you, as Andre absolutely accurately says, you hope that the administration doesn't actually want to blow up the WTO. Now, that's something you could have pretty much relied on in the case of George W. Bush. It's emphatically not anything you can rely on in the case of Donald Trump, which is why I, for one, think it's a dangerous route to go down.
Was it a mistake, Andre, to impose retaliatory tariffs?
Look, I think it depends the way you look at it.
It's a good answer.
I was very much against the EU imposing the measure. But in retrospect, I'm not sure that I was right. And I think that the EU found a good way of dealing with the problem. So let's go back a little bit to the two routes. So if indeed, as the US did choose to go through the national security, and if the US were found to be justified, okay, if the judges did find that, okay, well, yes, there is a national security problem in the US, you know, steel production have come to a very low level, and, you know, yes, you know, who are we to judge? Either we cannot judge, or yes, we find that there is a case here. Then indeed, well, there's nothing you can do. The only thing that the EU could do is start to wield the same instrument. And certainly the EU would not want to do that, because then the system is kaput completely. It's not just the US, then, you know, all the big players would start to use it, and the next day the system unravels. So the EU does not want to see the system unravel and could not have done anything. Okay. At the same time, I think the EU, like everybody else, made the judgment that this was not a genuine national security. Okay. So either it was just a protectionist of the same kind that, you know, Bush Jr. used back in 2002, or it was really trying to poke a hole at the WTO. And in both cases, the EU was worried that this case would lead to further cases on the part of the US, and therefore it needed to show to the US that it's willing to push back. So what the EU do? The EU said, well, you know, your measures, they are really safeguard measures. You are calling them national security, but they are exactly the same measures that President Bush had put in place in 2002. No. When a country uses safeguards, it is entitled to retaliate, to have compensation. If the country, here the US, should have offered to the EU, said, well, you know, we have a problem in steel, but because we have a problem in steel, we are going to put tariffs, but we are offering you something in another domain. There needs to be some kind of rebalancing. The US cannot use the safeguard or any other country without consulting with its partners. It cannot be unilateral. It needs to take the measure and then consult with others. You know, yeah, guys, I have a problem here. I'm putting measures on steel, but, you know, I'm giving you something in another domain, agriculture or whatever. If the country, in this case the US, does not do that, then after 3 months, the EU would have been entitled to put in place retaliation, which is it did back in 2002. And so here the EU said, you know, you're telling me it's national security, but, you know, my lawyers are telling me this is not national security. You're taking a safeguard. And therefore, I'm in the logic of safeguard. After 3 months, I did not receive compensation. Bang, I put measures. The US has disputed that. But in a sense, you can see also a deal to be found, right? We have put a case against the US on national security. They have put a case against us for using anti-safeguard measures in, you know, not justified. Then you could see a deal made in Geneva or between Brussels and Washington. You drop your measures, I drop mine. So maybe it wasn't that idiotic a route to follow.
So we talked steel, we talked cars, we talked national security. We haven't talked yet about airplanes and Boeing and Airbus and the decision by the WTO to give a case to the US in its claim against Airbus. Alan, do you want to walk us through that point? Because I think it's part of the wider big relation, transatlantic trade relation that we are currently discussing. Obviously, the big picture here is also that there has been some sort of an agreement to negotiate a new trade agreement between President Juncker and President Trump. That discussion is politely said not advancing a lot. But officially, there is still a discussion ongoing. So where do we stand in all of this? And perhaps we start off with the airplanes. I mean, with Airbus, but then zoom in, then broaden it up a little bit too.
So Airbus Boeing is interesting, and it's sort of interesting it comes now because, in a sense, it's like sort of a different procedure. You know, it's a whole series of litigation that goes back, I think, about 15 years. And I remember right at the beginning when I just actually started writing about trade, when the first cases were launched, and said, this is extraordinary. They're going to mediate this huge thing in the WTO. And a very wise Washington trade lawyer says, Alan, you have to remember that for the United States, litigation is often simply a way of structuring negotiation, right? You both get a bunch of rulings that works out the parameters of where you can be, and then you get to a deal. Now, in one sense, it's unfortunate it's come up now when you have an administration that doesn't necessarily think in those multilateral ways. Nonetheless, I think it's the recent decision against the EU and the tariffs that the US are going to put on are actually part of a perfectly sort of rules-based system. The US didn't actually go over the top. It didn't retaliate as much as it might have done. And there's a reasonable expectation that when the EU gets a counter-ruling or its own ruling against Boeing next summer, there's a bit of an unfortunate timing issue, then the Americans will sit down at the table. You know, an important thing to understand here is the mindset of somebody like Bob Lighthizer, the US trade representative. Okay, he's very robust, and he has skepticism about the WTO, but something like Airbus Boeing is something he's actually reasonably keen on, right? It's a robust bit of litigation where you can get a ruling and you can actually, you know, affect a change of behavior. So it is quite possible, if other things haven't blown up, we could get a reasonable deal on Airbus Boeing. And in a sense, kind of Airbus Boeing is how things are supposed to work. You know, that's how they're supposed to work. And we end up, after 15 years, admittedly, of putting an awful lot of trade lawyers' children through college, with something that might be a more durable system for the medium term.
Well, I think we are coming to an end, but André, perhaps you want to add a few remarks on the Airbus Boeing, but perhaps also on the more general and what you see.
On the Airbus Boeing, and going from there to a more general, I very much agree with what Alan has just said, 100%. I would just add a small maybe footnote. Maybe there is a silver lining in this, which is a victory. Or presented as a victory for President Trump based on a WTO ruling. In a sense, maybe he can see that the WTO, on which he's clearly a very skeptical, I mean, I think he's skeptical of anything multilateral, not just the WTO, but WTO being one of them, and, you know, having a system of dispute settlement and rulings that you have to abide to, he's clearly skeptical of that. Maybe the fact that here he's gotten a victory, in a sense, maybe in the narrative that helps him a little bit to, you know, tone down his anti-WTO system. And he has been saying completely wrong and completely false, a complete lie, you can say. He has been saying that, you know, it's the first victory that the US got. I mean, as if it was his victory, that thanks to him, in a sense, he presenting that the WTO had to give it to him because he's such a great negotiator. WTO, you know, had to give to Trump what it has not given to earlier president. It's complete nonsense, but okay, it's, you know.
He can sell it domestically.
He can sell it domestically. Right. And I think since the narrative, and that was the start of our conversation, the threats and the narrative, I think the narrative is as important, if not more important, in his trade measures than the actual measures. So that fits nicely, but at the same time, it works also with the system. So I would almost say it's a win-win. Too bad that the EU obviously has to pay the price for the moment. But as Alan said, well, by next summer at the latest, there will be the ruling on the WTO in favor of the EU. And then we will sit at the table and deal with this.
Well, I'm afraid that's all the time we have. We end with a Chinese win-win. I think that's something we should discuss perhaps in the next special edition of this podcast, Sound of Economics, which was featuring today Alan Beattie, the FT senior writer on trade based here in Brussels, and André Sapir, senior fellow here at Bruegel. Thanks for joining and see you next time. Bye-bye.